This is section 8 of our master outline, the covenant people restored, preparation for the new covenant. Now we have seen in broad outline the way Ezekiel had to hold before these people what this glorious restoration was to be. Now how is this going to be worked out in time? How does God proceed from these people in exile? The people are restored as a religious community, not as an independent political unit. I think that's the first point we ought to make. The people are actually, in fact, restored as a religious, worshiping, working community, not as a political unit. Only during the time of the Maccabees are they in any way to be considered an independent unit, and that is only under tremendous, after much bloodshed and under tremendous duress, and then it's only for a short time again, too. It is something that definitely is doomed. They remain a part of some nation until the fall of Jerusalem, 70 AD. And then they don't even remain as an independent religious worshiping community, but then they become a scattered people. Israel is restored until the fullness of time. When Jesus Christ is born and crucified, when the temple veil is torn, sacrifices are rendered obsolete, and the earthly temple loses its significance, the believing people become the temple of God. And we see that this is where the movement is. That religious community is to get the people there so that Christ can be born in the fullness of time. That the nation of Rome has the roads paved so that the gospel indeed of the risen Christ can go forth without hindrance throughout. A little nationalistic political unit of Israel would have been a great hindrance to that, you know. But to be part of the Roman Empire was a tremendous advantage. And if they had remained a strictly closed little monarchy, they would not have either have had the advantage of that one language, the Greek language, that became the basic vehicle for the spreading of the gospel and the spreading of the Roman system of communication order. Oh no, it was time for that monarchy to go away. The concept of kingdom had been taught. It was time for the monarchy to disappear. To have kept the monarchy would have been a tremendous disadvantage. That's why Jesus wanted nothing to do either with the monarchy. He didn't want to be crowned an earthly king. That would simply thwart and hamstring the whole program of the great river flowing down through the ages. Now in the remaining book that we have, we deal with the returned people. The stress is on the restitution of a former way of life to an extent. They do pick up the sanctified worship and service, the building. These things are definitely necessary. More emphasis comes on the Messiah priest, the king, the prince priest. We'll see that especially when we get to Zechariah, how, in a way, he becomes a very central figure. And then the providence of God, man, it's amazing how anyone would ever be able to read these books without ever getting a concept of the providence of God, and yet some have. You talk about the Lord showing that he's a sovereign God and ruling all, controlling the various forces. As some of these confessions that he pulled from the mouths of some of the big monarchs to get Jerusalem rebuilt, it's truly amazing. Now, our handling of the book, you may wonder why I got them lined up the way I have. There's a reason. I have a reason, I should say. It's not chronological in the order of writing. No. Haggai should be first in this section. Haggai was written about 520. Zechariah, the first part, right after that. But we take the history books first because they do give us a good setting, as before, and the way I have them arranged, they will find that they tie in pretty well. I think at least they do. Now, Ezra, the book itself, covers two parts of history. 538 to 516. 538 to 516. And this is before Ezra's time. And but there's a section in these first six chapters that covers 538 to 516 that tells about what happens way down at about 450. And the second section deals in that period between 450 and 460 BC. So, 1 to 6 is 538 to 516. And then 7 to 10 is about 460 to 450. However, as we'll see, part of this refers to what happened at this time here, or right around here. Nehemiah comes in about 445. While we're at this, Esther comes in at about 470, 460. Right in this area here is where Esther is thought to be. But Esther is not really continuous, a real part of the story, so I'm not bringing her in on the history part of it. As it refers to the to Jerusalem, Esther refers to an episode that happened back in the exile area. Now, the first four verses of Ezra 1 deals with the proclamation in the first year of Cyrus to fulfill the word of the Lord as spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah. The Spirit of God stirs up Cyrus so that he send a proclamation throughout and put it in writing saying, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Where whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. Let him go to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Now this last phrase, he is the God who is in Jerusalem, has been interpreted to, and I think there's something to this, that Cyrus said, okay, there's a great God. And I know there's a great God. He's given me great things. Now, the Edomites have their God, and I'm going to honor that the Edomites, because the historical secular records indicate that what he did for Jerusalem, he was ready to do for other nations too, to get them resettled in their land and to get them, help them get their worship restored also. So what he did did for Israel does not seem to have been just a specific, unique situation. Again, you might be able to debate this. This is a real juicy bone for a good term paper sometime in some other section. Time will tell. Remember Isaiah 44, the last verse, and Isaiah 45, verse 1, where Isaiah said that God was going to call up Cyrus and put his spirit upon him. Now, Isaiah spoke this way back in the 700s. Now, in the 500s, this happened. Of course, if you find it difficult to accept the supernatural revelation in the time of God dealing with his people in preparation for Christ coming on earth, then you're going to say that there had to be two Isaiahs, because for an Isaiah to so specifically say that this Cyrus was going to be stirred up with the Spirit, yes, that takes faith. Just downright faith. God given faith. Tom?
Is this a political policy of Cyrus that he was going to restore the people to their land so they would be loyal to him? Is that what he really had in mind?
That was the Persian and Median policies, and they divided the whole country, the whole empire, into 120 satraps, and instead of keeping a discontented people in their places, they could stay where they wanted if they wanted to. They could go back if they wanted to. If they wanted to go back and restore their places, it all had to be paid out of the great treasury. That was his policy, but he ruled with an iron fist through his satraps. And he reorganized the whole empire that way. That was a universal national policy, or a national policy for the whole empire. Yeah. Okay. Note that he states here about whoever wishes to go back. And we heard last night that whoever does not mean everyone. everybody, but it means this one, that one, and that one. I was going to assume we had it to Mount Salem last night. So it is. Those in whom the Lord has now put the desire to return, you may go. You may go. And you who stay, support those that go. Again, you don't have to, but whoever is so inclined. So there's definitely three categories allowed for. The one that stays and wants nothing to do with it, those that stay and are ready to support, and those that are ready to go. He makes this threefold distinction. Without making any kind of a judgment, I mean, Cyrus makes no judgment at all, puts no pressure on these people whatsoever. If you want to go, go. If you want to stay here and support them, do so. If you want to stay here and forget all about it, fine. You know, it seems to be quite a strategic policy. Cyrus was in control for a couple hundred years. I mean, this worked real well for the Medes and the Persians for about 200 years, this type of the imperial policy. All right. Compliance with the proclamation, chapter 1, verses 5 to 11. The heads of Judah and Benjamin, priests and Levites, those that are served by the Spirit of God. Notice here that this is a thing, again, that's motivated by the Spirit of God. Here you get that problem again of sovereign action and human responsibility. Those that were served by the Spirit of God, they went. Those whom were awakened and evoked. All we read is that there were some who couldn't prove their Jewish descent, but I think they wanted only Jews. I think that's very definite. Very, very definite. They had to prove they were of the line. And when we get to the end of the book, we'll find out that they wanted a pure Jewish community, nothing but. So I don't think there were any that were not Jews. They really had to prove their lineage. Or there had to be good circumstantial evidence to support it. Elton?
Well, back in what we were studying, there would be no foreigners in
it. No uncircumcised, that's true. Yeah. That's what Ezekiel had said, but again, the uncircumcised there, again, anyone who circumcised his heart was one of the Lord. Yeah. But in this case, it was indeed a Jewish community, only a Jewish community. Let's pick this up when we get this in the last chapter. Maynard?
Well,
in this specific case, I would just hold up that point right now in abeyance. There is to be a covenant community according to the old demarcation. This is to be reestablished. And it's to be a people that is a separate people, a separated people, a distinct people. And therefore, in the last chapter, chapter 10 on marriage, boy, they apply this with a vengeance. Yeah. So the restored community is strictly a restored covenant community, led by Zerubbabel. By the way, notice too that Cyrus restored all the articles from the house, the last part of chapter 1. That shows that they must have kept very good records there, knowing exactly what came from where. And this had been quite some time before already, you know. And yet he knows exactly what came from Jerusalem and what came from the temple, and was able to say, okay, here's your treasures, take them back. It indeed shows that, and archaeologists have found too, you know, that they had a very good storage system in those days, and also a good recording system. They were by no means people that just lived haphazardly in caves. Chapter 2. Zerubbabel is the first one named, and he is of the Davidic house, along with a few other leaders, various categories that were still very definitely discernible, family lines, priests, Levites, singers, servants. And that whole chapter 2, we'll pass that by, except to find out in the last part of the chapter, some had lost their genealogical proof. And verse 59. But they were not able to give evidence of their father's household and their descendants, whether they were of Israel. And verse 62. These searched among them, among their ancestral registration, but could not be located. Therefore, they were considered unclean and were excluded from the priesthood. Now, that refers in 62 to the priests. It doesn't say that they were excluded from the nation as such. as long as they had circumstantial evidence, then they were accepted as people of the community. But a priest who could not, by ancestral line, I'm the son of so-and-so, and have the actual tree record right there, not a hope. We're not going to consider you a genuine Levite until you can prove it by the record. We're not going to have any intrusion in the priestly office. And note in the last verse, when they got to Palestine, now the priests and the Levites, some of the people, the singers and the gatekeepers, and the temple servants lived in their cities, and all Israel in their cities. They didn't all go to ruin Jerusalem. Because some of these people that went back went to Lachish, others went to Bethlehem, others went to Bethel, or whatever the town may be, Jericho, whatever these towns were around. They went back to the town that they were taken from originally. Now, in chapter 3, in the seventh month, that is very likely after the edict, now the people come together to Jerusalem, and they come for the Feast of Booths, chapter 3, verse 4. They celebrate the Feast of Booths, and indeed they had to live in booths because the city was, there were no houses and there was no temple. So but all they could do was be in booths. Priests, Joshua and his brothers, and the prince of Zerubbabel build the altar, and the order of sacrificial service begins right there, without the temple walls. The first thing they put up is the altar, because that is the all-important thing. Then they make plans to get the material for the temple. Chapter 3, verse 7. And they order the materials from Tyre and Sidon. Evidently, they must have things staked out. They knew where the altar was going to be. They set up the altar. They start their worship ritual. And then they start laying the foundation. The Levites in charge. And note their unity in verse 9. They really work together. And when the foundations were laid, when they got as far as the people outside here, then they stopped. And George, Jack?
Did they have a copy of the law at this time?
I think so.
By word of mouth.
No, I think they would have had a copy of this. I don't think Ezra rewrote the law. This is a critical idea. No, I think that the law was kept. Once it was written, they had a written copy before them all the time. Because when it speaks here about according to the law, and I think there's Nehemiah talks about too that he did everything according to the law, and Ezra was a student of the law, and he carefully studied it, and he went there to practice it. No, I think he definitely had a copy of the law. In chapter 4, oh, by the way, the last part of chapter 3, the noise of the weeping was so loud that it couldn't hear the noise of the singing and shouting. It all depended from what vantage point you looked at. If you're an old fellow remembering the glories of the old, it was awful, this raunchy new beginning. But if you didn't remember the old and you thought of what the possibilities were, hip hooray. Doesn't it make a tremendous difference what your perspective is? If you look at the present in the light of the past, if you've had a rough time, well, oh, it's only the past. If you don't remember the past too well and you think of small beginnings you got, well, Zechariah had to speak to that point, didn't he? Woe unto those that despise the day of small beginnings. Well, we'll get that on Thursday. Now the enemy. First is the offer to help. Undoubtedly these are Samaritans, because by the way they refer to themselves in the last part of last part of verse 2. And they are refused. We're going to do this ourselves. We're not going to have a mixture. The king of Persia commanded us to do this, and we're going to do it on our own. And then the opposition begins. And verses 4 and 5. Now, it's very important that you understand what's read here. Verse 4. Then the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and frightened them from building, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their counsel all the days of Cyrus king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius king of Persia, even until the reign. And what they do now, in verse 6 up through chapter 23, they give an illustration of what happened during the reign of Artaxerxes and Darius.
the second, way down the line.
I think the best way I can show this is, you remember, if we just start with the outline again, this is Josiah, the days of Jeremiah. Then we had Jehoiakim, and then Jehoiakim, it was at this time then that Ezekiel went into captivity. This then would be 596. Then there's a short period of Jehoiakim, then Zedekiah. Then we get 586. Ezekiel finishes prophesying at 570. If you keep moving on down the line now, the edict to return comes at 538. 520, Haggai and Zechariah come on the scene. 516, the temple is finished. They begin temple building here. Temple building begins here. It's finished over here. Now as we move along, we get Esther about 485, we'll say. And then we get Ezra, as we said, about 450 or 460. Make it 460. Then Nehemiah comes 445. This is Nehemiah. And then Malachi about 430. Now, Ezra is over here. Sorry, that's Esther. Ezra is over here. And he's writing about what happens over here in chapters 1 to 6. He's writing about what happens in this period. And then when he says, and they bothered us all the time, and to give a concrete illustration of how they really try to stop them, he takes something that happened over here. Follow? Something that happened in the way that the people were still opposing, they still hadn't finished the city, way over here, see? They started the temple at 538. By the time they got to 460, they still didn't have the city finished. They had the temple finished, but the city wasn't finished. And then when the people were trying to get the city finished under Ezra and Nehemiah, then Tatnai, the rascal, tries to get the king to stop it. Just as if there had never been an edict telling them that they could build. So, chapter 4, 6 to 23 relates an instance of what happened over here in the days, right in the day when Ezra was there. Are you keeping up from the end? Yes, then. Sorry?
And you say these were the Samaritans who were bothering them during
the... Initially. Tatnai was not, he was a governor. He was one of the governors, one of the satraps. But initially over here, Ezra is telling the story. Remember now, Ezra lives here at this time. He starts his book telling what happened before he was born. He tells about how they got the temple started. And there was joy and weeping at the foundation. Then as they begin to build, the Samaritans come. And the Samaritans try to get the king to stop them.
Now, where are these Samaritans? Who are these people? What descent are they?
They say it themselves here, that let us build with you, for we will seek, we like you seek your God, and we have been sacrificing to him since the days of Ezra had it. You have to read 2 Kings 17. Remember when we talked about the Samaritans, this mixed, whole mixed group that came there, that got afraid of the lions, and they were taught how to fear God and became a real mixture? These are the people. They had not been carried captive a second time. When a city was captured, they simply became part of the Babylonian Empire. So, they're giving trouble. And then Ezra writes and says, and you know, we had opposition all the time. Even way late until we got the city finished. We had opposition from 538 right on to 545. Nehemiah writes about having to work with trowel and sword. While they're building, they got to stand there and knock off the enemy. So that means they had an opposition way up along here yet, until the whole city was rebuilt. So Ezra, I'm saying this simply to understand the book, takes an illustration from this area and then sandwiches it here as an illustration. of how they had opposition throughout that whole period.
What's that date from Ezra? 460?
I got about 460 here, but Ezra, 460, 450, yes. And then this is Nehemiah. This is Malachi.
Now, then the last verse of chapter 4 takes us right back to here again. Takes us right back to 538. And he's in this period here. So when the temple was started and the people were building, and here come the Samaritans, they said, we want to help you. No, we're going to go our own way. And then when the Samaritans saw that they were going to go on, they resisted them and they stopped building. 538, 536, 537, 536, right along this street here. They stopped building. And there the temple lay. Just where you start. Foundations made, and maybe a few stones on top of each other, and that was it. Now the work of rebuilding recommences. It was the prophet Haggai and the prophet Zechariah. And these two prophets give their dates, as we will see, and it's very definitely 520 B.C. That's 16, 18 years after they had quit building the temple. For 16, 18 years, the temple had been laying there, just partially built. Haggai and Zechariah begin to preach. And Zerubbabel and Joshua, the prince and the priest together, they listen to the preaching, they are picked up, they are stirred up, and they go right to work. And the work recommences. Now the enemies try to stop again. Now this is another instance. Now Tatanai comes in, the governors of the area with, that is the fellow that was in charge there, and he sees this thing going too far, and he says, hey, who told you to do this, you bunch of rebels and revolters? And the Jews say, we are appointed men. And this time they did not stop, chapter 5, verse 4 and 5. And then Tatnai wrote a letter to King Cyrus, and he gave it the decree, and this is true. Is this true? They write, and Cyrus writes back, by this time it's Darius, who's in charge of Babylon, because it was through Babylon that they were to go back, because they had been brought to Babylon. And they look up, and Darius is there, finds that the edict is there, and boy, you talk about table turned. Oh, Tatnai is told, you get busy, you leave those people alone, and what's more, you pay for it. You pay for it, man. You stay away, that is verse chapter 6, verse 7, and you raise taxes for building, 6, verse 8. You give even supplies for their worship, verses 9 and 10. And if there's anyone who violates it, you will be impaled. Now, you all know what impalation is, don't you? Anyone here that does not know what impalation was? Very simply, this is the ground. They dug a hole in the ground. They put a pole in there. They put a sharp point on that pole, and they stripped the person, and they forced them right onto the pole so that the pole would go right up into their body. And they were left with the four limbs just set out to die. That was, in a way, even more cruel than crucifixion. He will be impaled. By the way, there's evidence that the Assyrians impaled quite a few of the Jewish people too, when they took them captive, and the Babylonians did this too for all the obstreperous women. It were especially women that they loved to impale. Just force them right down, and then they just tear their whole insides to pieces, you know, and then the lifeblood, lymphs and everything else would just slowly drain right down the pole, and they'd be left to die on a pole. He will be impaled. Can you imagine why Tatnai went to work in a hurry? Well, that's what it tells us there. Boy, and he left no table unturned. And he went to work, and he collected taxes, and he sent gifts. And the temple was finished within 4 years, 615. And the services were begun. Passover was celebrated 19 to 22. And what great joy. So So this was a period of 20 years from the time, or 22 years from the time that the edict was given, that the temple was actually finished. But remember, there's that about a 6 year lacunae there where the people weren't doing anything. And here's where Haggai's prophecy and Zechariah's prophecy come in so beautifully, the way they preach to get these people moving again. But you read Zechariah and Haggai now in this situation of the interlude in temple building. They stopped because they were afraid of the crowd. Now Ezra comes to Jerusalem, and now we move on down the calendar in chapter 7, down to about this point. From now on, what we read about is from this point on. In other words, the temple has now been in operation about 55 years. 55 years after the temple has been erected, the city walls are still not, the city is not completed. But the temple is. The temple worship is supposed to be going on. The priestly order is there. All this. Now, Ezra in chapter 7 gets it in his heart that he wants to go from Babylon. He gets permission from the king. Who is he? He is a son of Hilkiah, a grandson of the priest Hilkiah from Josiah's time. In verse 6, he's a man who's skilled in the law. So the law must have been there in written form. Tom?
Could you give us a little, according to the calendar, who was the ruling Mede or ruling Persian during the time Darius came in,
Alright. Cyrus for a period here. Then Darius the First. Then there was a Xerxes or Artaxerxes. Then there was Darius the Second. And then there was Xerxes. Artaxerxes seems to have been, or Xerxes was first. I'm a bit foggy on this, but this is the Ahasuerus of Esther's time. That was Xerxes, definitely. So it was Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes, Darius the Second, Artaxerxes. As I recall this from my, I didn't dig up my notes to look at that, the details of this. I'm not trying, this is what you should work at carefully when you take a course in Bible history, where you really correlate the various nations with the nation of Israel. He's skilled in the law. Requests to go to Jerusalem and some of the temple people with him. Now note in verse 10 what his intent was. To make the law a living reality in Jerusalem. To study, to practice, and to teach the law. That was a noble thing. The law is not just the Ten Commandments. By the law, he's referring to the Torah, the revelation of God as they had it. That's what the scribe was. The scribe was, in a way, a teacher. Call him a professor. Call him a writer. In modern-day terms. But this is basically what his intent was. To study, to practice, and to teach it. And then he gets the letter of the king authorizing him. And he gives a specific copy of that. And I think the purpose of him repeating this authorization was because of what he's going to do in the community. People could go with him, verse 13. There were to be additional gifts, and he gets a special grant again through verse 15. The royal treasury is to supply his needs for the house. Everything's to be done with zeal. In verse 24, there's tax exemption for the temple people. And he's told to enforce the laws of your God. And then Ezra's response to this letter, praise the Lord. He who has put such a thing as this in the king's heart to adorn the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. Notice, not to build, but to beautify. To adorn, and has extended loving kindness to me before the king and his counselors and before all the king's mighty princes. And I was strengthened according to the hand of the Lord my God upon me. And I gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me. I spoke about the providence of God a while ago. Praise be God who put such a thing in the heart of this man. This is what we really mean by God at work, God providing, God leading, God overruling, God's providence. On to chapter 8. These now are the people who went. And there's not an awful lot in there that really should occupy our attention. The people, a whole group, in the first 15 verses, he notes there's no Levite, and then he gets a bunch of Levites, and that swells the crowd to 250 more. And yes, it's interesting to note that since he talks so wonderfully about how God is his God and how God provides, etc., he doesn't ask the king for an escort. If I trust the Lord to supply me for materials, do I also need an armed guard? Really not. So they pray and fast and proceed, and all goes well. The Levites have to carry the wealth, verses 24 to 30, and in due time they arrive in Jerusalem. And Ezra loses no time, verses 32 to 36, to give a copy of the letter to the rulers around him, so that he's an efficient fellow. Before he starts working and raising antipathy, he's going to let these fellows know that he's here at the behest of the king. And so he lets them all see a copy of this letter, and chapter 10. Now while Ezra was praying and making confession, now wait a minute, that's not it. We go to the chapter 9. That's where we get into the marriage problem. Chapter 8 is about, I was going to skip the chapter here. Chapter 9. Now when these things had been completed, the princes approached me. Who the princes are, we don't know. Not all the princes, because some of the princes had intermarried too. Saying, the people of Israel, the priests and the Levites, have not separated themselves from the people of the lands according to their abomination. And I think that's the important phrase to note here. A while ago, Maynard, you raised this point about universalism, etc. They have not separated themselves from the people according to their abomination. Of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, Egyptians, and Amorites. And how were these abominations coming back in amongst the people? Marriage. By marriage. Please note that the point is they have not separated themselves from their abominations. It isn't that they objected to the people per se as people. There were some princes who objected to the idol worship, the ritual, the customs of the idol worshiping people were being reintroduced amongst God's people. This is what was being objected to, not the people as people. And when I heard this matter, verse 3, I tore my garment and my robe and pulled some of my hair from my head and my beard and sat down appalled. Boy, that was a sign of really, real, real grief. And everyone who trembled at the words of the God of Israel on account of the unfaithfulness of the Israel gathered to me, and I sat appalled. And all those that realized what was wrong, then at evening time he arose, verse 5, and he kept his torn garment and robe on, and he stretched out his hands and he prayed. And then we have his prayer there. The shame that's there is because of the iniquity and the guilt, of which captivity was a sure result before. And now while they're enjoying a moment of grace, verses 8 and 9, they're guilty of the same iniquity and shame again. They deserve to be broken again. That's the effect of this prayer. God, this moment of grace is being used to simply repeat the iniquity and the guilt of the past. Grace has been given to us, and people use it to shame themselves. Oh God, oh God. Now, we are guilty, he confesses, of breaking the express commands concerning marriage, verses 11 to 14, and he specifically refers to these laws on marriage. God, thou art righteous. We are an escaped remnant. We are guilty. What now? And note, it isn't Ezra that makes the proposal. It isn't Ezra, the fellow that came into the community, that makes the proposal. Many writers have set Ezra up as an ogre, you know. A monster. It isn't Ezra who comes up with the proposal that these marriages be annulled, that these men who married women from the outside, that they be put away. Oh, no. It isn't he that makes the proposal at all. Chapter 10, verse 2. Chapter 10, verse 1, first. Now, while Ezra was praying and making confession, weeping and prostrating himself before the house of God, a very large assembly, men, women, and children, gathered in from Israel, for the people wept bitterly. And Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, answered and said to Ezra, "We have been unfaithful to our God. We have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. Yet now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. Let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and their children, according to the counsel of my Lord, and of those who tremble at the commandments of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Arise, for this matter is your responsibility, but we will be with you. Be courageous and act." It isn't Ezra's idea, his proposal. It comes from one of these men himself who says, "We have married," and very likely he confesses, "I'm one of these guilty ones." The sorrow and the penitence and the grief of an Ezra must have indeed been used of God to work on this man's heart. And so, but Ezra, you are the one who's got the authority. Shechaniah didn't have the authority. You see, Ezra had quoted that letter before in chapter 7 that he had received. And yes, he had authority to carry out the law of his God. So what could anybody say? What could these people say that had to take their women back home? What could the people at home say? Carry out the law of your God. And nobody argued that this was the law of God. This marrying of other women, bringing in the abominations of the nation. Be courageous and act. And Ezra arose and made the leading priest the Levites, and all Israel take oath that they would do according to this proposal. And they took oath. And they said, they stand with him. Then Ezra rose from before the house of God and went into the chamber of Jehohanan, the son of Eliashib. Although he went there, he did not eat bread, drink water, for he was mourning over the unfaithfulness of the exiles. And they made a proclamation to the Jews and Jerusalem, to all the exiles, that they should be assembled at Jerusalem. And they call all the people. And whoever would not come would have to forfeit their inheritance. And so the men came. Everybody came, trembling because of the matter and shivering because of the great rain. Must have been, they can have some pretty severe rains there at certain times of the year. There they all stood outside, shaken because what's going to happen to us. And the rain. And Ezra stood up and said, "You have been unfaithful. You have married foreign wives, adding to the guilt of Israel. Now therefore, make confession to the Lord God of your fathers, and do his will, and separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives." And then all the people answered and said with a loud voice, "That's right. As you have said, so it is our duty to do." And then they go on to say, "We have sinned greatly, but right here in the rain, we can't immediately undo all this. How about if you appoint special leaders and they come around to the city, to our special, to the places where we are, and then let this thing be done decently and in order, one place at a time." And so they went. Verse 17, "And they finished investigating all the men who had married foreign wives by the first of the month. And they found out that Joshua, the great high priest, of whom we're going to read beautiful things in Zechariah, and not so beautiful things. But Joshua, the high priest, he had a son, and he had sons and nephews that had brought in foreign wives with abomination. The first ones mentioned, the very priesthood, had already succumbed in a period of 60 years. And the princes, and the people."
How do you put away a foreign wife? I wondered, when you talk about putting them away, what happens to it? What does it do?
I guess your imagination is as fertile as mine. Isn't it, Tom?
Yes, I guess so. Well, I already alluded to what I think my imagination came up with, and that is, Ezra had the decree, and that he was to carry out the law of the people, and he had made known to all the people around, he had already said that before, so that when these women with their children came back to their home country, they knew why. The people at home knew why Grandpa all of a sudden had a divorced daughter with a couple of children at home. It was because of the fact that they had no business getting married in the first place. There's nothing said about these people remarrying. You know, there's a lot of questions I like to ask too about this situation. But it was a reversal of what had happened before. Before they had married foreign women, they kept them. We saw with Solomon what had happened. We saw what happened with Ahaz, the son of the crown prince, the son of Hezekiah, marrying the daughter of Jezebel and Ahaz. That beautiful institution of marriage, that God-ordained institution of marriage, for the continuity of his work of grace, it's integral to that. It is the first area that the devil continually makes attacks on. And here you had it again. Okay.
I don't know whether you made it clear or not. Does this refer to any and all foreign wives? I mean, could there have been some that had saved and proselytized and converted to Judaism?
Undoubtedly, because of the emphasis there, they who came in with their abominations. The proselyte woman, undoubtedly, she who had become completely identified, there had been room for that before, and I don't see that would in any way now be annulled. But remember, the phrase started here, and they have married women, they have brought in abominations to marriage. And this is what some of the princes were so concerned about. That the tragedy of the past was going to be relived. And again, class, it isn't that because it's a favorite theme of mine, but it's because it's such an obvious theme. Watch out, we marry. There goes the woman as well as man. The home. The marriage relationship. It is basic. It is fundamental. Then. And now. And so much so here that evidently God's blessing rested upon this tragic act. Oh, what a pain and what a sorrow there must have been. Undoubtedly, some of these people really loved each other. It's not being a love in the Lord. There was a love bond there. And I can well see that some of these Jewish fathers had really come to love some of their half-breed children. This is painful. The chastisement as a result of sin can be very hard to endure at times. Some people have said that the book of Ruth was written at this time by one of the mothers that was being sent away, and she quick sat down and wrote a book and said, if Rahab could stay, a harlot could come in and stay, and if a Ruth could come in and stay, why do we have to be sent off? They have tried to find a historical situation why the book of Ruth is there, but the book of Ruth obviously belongs to the Greater the Judges and has no application here whatsoever. The whole point is here, the abomination. God, and remember, in the restoration program, it's that holiness, it's that separation that God insisted on. And I just want to make one comment here. In Australia, I worked at the University of Melbourne for 7 to 8 years. I was quite closely allied with some of the IVF work. I had the opportunity to take an IVF leader's training camp for about 5-6 days where we'd kind of take a crash course and go through all the Bible studies that they were going to use on the campus during the course of the year. And we went through a couple books that were here with them. The thing that used to be so painful, I'm thinking of two Fijian girls that came to Australia. And I worked with the Australian Nurses Christian Movement, the Australian Christian Nurses Movement, and Timpi and Eliza, two girls, came from Fiji, devout Christian girls. from all outward appearance. Girls that were absolutely convinced that once a Christian, always a Christian. And they came for nurses' training. And they really had a rush from these Australian fellows. And Eliza finally agreed to marry a fellow from the Church of England, High Church Chap. The last time we talked with Eliza, Eliza couldn't look me in the eyes. And I said to her, Eliza, you don't look happy. And she came back to me almost with a viciousness. But I had to make a choice. And I said, what? She said, it's awful to go unmarried all through your life. The man was a member of the church. But as soon as he were married, he refused to have anything to do with it, and slowly on Eliza was going along with him. Tempe, this was, Eliza was in Melbourne. Tempe went up to Sydney to get away from a few of these fellows that were on her tail. And one time she was picked up by a young real estate fellow, and he offered a big, beautiful home, and Tempe gave in. But Tempe is managing to keep up a semblance of Christian life. And now and then we hear from Tempe. But oh, how she does long and cry for a Christian home, which she doesn't have. And I've talked with her husband a couple of times. No, Tempe knew what I was when she married me. I think that of the IVF young people I worked with at the University of Melbourne that one year, there were about 45, 50 that were regular. By the time they become graduates and get out in society, most of these had married and had not married Christians. And when we get our graduate fellowship meetings together, out of a group of 45, 50, we'd be, it's tragic, but we would say we'd be lucky if we got 10, 15 out of that group. The greatest majority of IVF students became ineffective. I'm not saying that they became apostate. Became ineffective for the Lord. Got into a home situation that was a tragedy through marriage. This constantly continues to happen. To be unequally yoked in worship is awful. To be unequally yoked in marriage is just as bad. Because life is one, worship and marriage. Well, the Lord made strong, strong words against this, and he took drastic action through a community. What can we do in the church today? What are you going to do with young people who look at a face rather than at the heart? It's always a problem.
What do you do when a couple comes in and wants to marry, and both are not Christian, only one member of the Christian? What's your attitude towards that?
Well, the church in Australia took a definite stand. You, as a member of the church, you are not free from the church's regulation, from the church's point of view, to do this, to marry such a couple, until he has agreed to have a lengthy period of instruction and make promises afterwards and so on. They did leave a bit of a loophole there. But as a minister, as a guest minister there, a missionary, I was not permitted in any way to marry two unbelievers. Although I did plead that we look upon marriage as also as a creation ordinance and as a legal institution. And I've had young people that come to me with whom I felt I could have done a lot of work. I'm not saying I could have converted them. That's in the Lord's hand. But who were really turned off when I pulled out the book to them and I said, look, these are the regulations and I'm bound to this. And I tell you, no use going back to those people. So from that point of view, I wished I could have, as a servant of the state, not in any way involved in a Christian marriage, but as a servant of the state, simply be used as a servant of the state in legalizing this relationship. So that's what marriage is also. The marriage form is, after all, legalizing of a situation that has developed between two persons.